once again highly desired. How does China now describe itself? Victor Gao, once interpreter to the late reformer Deng Xiaoping, explains how he sees it.
China no longer considers itself as an orthodox communist society or a socialist society. We are socialism with Chinese characteristics, which can, as a matter of fact, equally mean capitalism with Chinese characteristics. We are emancipated. We are enlightened. It doesn't matter whether it's capitalism or socialism.
For others, like the economist Mao Yushe, the rather confusing official description of China's political economy, socialist market economy with Chinese characteristics, simply means
capitalist system governed by Communist Party. I understand republic means all organization in the country, they negotiate each other. Solution not got by a force. In China, I think that we are not the republic, because we solve the problem by force. The problem is solved by open the fire, not by reasoning.
Today, after 3 decades of headlong growth, many Chinese feel their country's at a crossroads, much as it was in May 1919, when thousands of students, mainly from Beijing University, marched to Tiananmen in protest against their weak government and called for the embrace of science and democracy in place of Confucianism. Victor Gao believes China will evolve peacefully.
What China can least afford is another revolution. China has been on a roller coaster. It has gone through one aggression after another, burning of the palaces, humiliation, face slapping, foreign aggression, and internal turmoil, civil war, political campaign, great cultural revolution, disasters, one after another, famine, and we had too much of that. What China needs is two things: maintaining stability at home and keeping peace in the world.
But the historian David Kelly reports the fears of many Chinese that darker times could be ahead.
There is a great deal of concern in China about distorted forms of nationalism, and that has come to the surface this year. Some people see a repetition of what happened in Germany in the 20s and 30s when the foundations of fascism were laid by history professors who said that Germany is totally unique and Germany is master of its own destiny. And similarly in China today, there are these voices.
On the streets of Beijing, the shoppers are riding the economic wave that's carried a few to fabulous riches and many others to modest prosperity in the last 30 years. Those dark fears of ultranationalism or serious unrest seem distant from scenes like these. But China spends more now on internal security than it does on external defence. Does that suggest that the government, at least, thinks this apparently harmonious prosperity is dangerously dependent on the economic lottery? Few people think the political journey that began with the fall of the last emperor is over. And nobody really knows where it'll end. Will it be another 100 years before China finds the answer? If you ask why it's taken so long, you get the same answer over and over again. China just needs more time.
I would say people in the outside of China, when they look at China, probably you need to give us a little bit more patience, a little bit more understanding. Come to China and try to adopt a more constructive attitude, and in having a very open and frank exchange of ideas. I don't think the Chinese are stupid. I think they are very smart. I think now they realize what they want. You know, they want better lives. They want to have greater transparency. And eventually they will get there.
The Shadow of the Emperor was presented by Isabel Hilton, produced by Anthony Denslow, and first broadcast last year.
Original British drama on BBC Two. A tale of love and repression in Edwardian England.
I know what it is that makes a man want to go away with a woman he likes, but that desire must be resisted.
Adapted for television by Tom Stoppard and starring Benedict Cumberbatch and Rebecca Hall.
You're such a paragon of honourable behaviour, Christopher. You're the cruelest man I know.
Bound by convention to duty and unhappiness.
I stand for monogamy. Monogamy and chastity.
Parade's End begins this Friday night at 9 on BBC Two.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 10:15. Coming up at 11:45, Verity Sharp introduces tonight's Late Junction. But now, from the stage of the Royal Albert Hall here in London, here's Catherine Bott with the second of this evening's proms.
Tonight, we're transporting ourselves in place and time, from Kensington to northern Italy and back 4 centuries to the year 1612, as I Fagiolini make their Royal Albert Hall proms debut, performing music from an imagined Vespers service on the feast of Our Lady of the Most Holy Rosary. We're going to hear polychoral music by Giovanni Gabrieli, who died in 1612, and by Lodovico Viadana, whose four-choir Vespers music was published in that year. And there'll be works by Giovanni Bassano, Alessandro Grandi, and, of course, Claudio Monteverdi. And to tell us something about this evocation of a church service from the homeland of the Baroque, standing beside me is the director of tonight's performance, Robert Hollingworth. Robert, there's no escaping the importance of Monteverdi's Vespers. How does tonight's repertoire stand up?
That's almost the most unfair question you could answer. It's like saying, with the greatest work of art in the world, how does this one look? I think what you can say straight away is that it's a more modern piece. Monteverdi seemed to be writing a collection, because it had Vesper Psalms and a Mass in it as well, that look, I can write in the old style, I can write in the new style, and I can combine the two. Viadana is writing something for a more modern-looking age, and he's writing a piece that much more clearly differentiates between the solo choir, the first of our four choirs in this, and the rest.
You're not moving your polychoral forces all round the building tonight. We might have expected you to be sending them here, there and everywhere, but they seem, all 33 of the singers, to be very much gathered on stage. Are you going to do any special effects with choreography?
Well, you'll have to wait, but I think the thing about this repertoire is that it's essentially very grand chamber music. It's chamber music on the most grand scale, and I believe that in chamber music the performers have to be able to hear each other and respond to each other, otherwise it's a kind of rather didactive time-following exercise. So I could pop a couple of the choirs up there, but they'd be following, they wouldn't be hearing. This is something that, you know, we think about St. Mark's, we think about St. Rock, the famous place where Gabrieli was our organist in charge, and that was quite a small space, St. Rock's. And if you think of the essentially conversational nature of the Gabrieli pieces, even though they seem very grand, you've got to make sure that the performers can actually hear each other. So it'll be a subtle thing.
And we've got several first performances at the proms, and a London premiere, and a world premiere. And you think, well, early music, how can there be a world premiere? But two pieces by Gabrieli, reconstructed by Hugh Keat, who's here tonight. Briefly, what does that reconstructive work entail?
As far as In Ecclesiis, which is a very well-known piece, is concerned, he's done two things. The first thing is, I think, fairly uncontroversial. He simply said, well, we discussed it over a lot of coffee and cake, but in a large building, it's not enough just to have a single player per part, so we've added a sort of musical cornflower of two extra choirs to give a bit more strength. But the other thing he's done is that there are two solo lines in the surviving parts from In Ecclesiis, but those surviving parts were only put together 3 years after he died, and it's Hugh's feeling that they were a sort of short score for a version when you didn't have the full money to spend on it. The Magnificat is a different kettle of fish in that only 8 of the, according to the title page, 20 or 28 parts exist, which is why no one's really bothered until now, because it's a very... There are times, as long as there's one part performing, or maybe 3 or 4, you've got an idea what the harmony is. But there are plenty of times in this where none of the performers are. So he's had to mix his genius for pastiche with some inspirational detective work that he's been doing about the reason for that the piece was written, or rather recomposed, we think.
Well, nobody much may have bothered a few centuries ago, but we're all going to be extremely glad that you and Hugh have bothered. Robert, thank you very much. To perform these sequences of sacred music, I Fagiolini are joined by three groups of instrumentalists, I Fagiolini's own string players, organists, pluckers and percussionists, the English cornet and sackbut ensemble, and a quintet of wind players, the City Music, all of them directed this evening by Robert Hollingworth, who's now on the podium. The composers of the first group of pieces are Viadana, Bassano and Grandi. Now we begin with Viadana's setting for four choirs of the versicle and response, Domine ad adjuvandum meum intende. O God, make speed to save me. O God, make haste to help me.
Here, Oh! Spiritus Sanctus,
Mirandi's heartbreaking lament of the Virgin for the dead Christ, Plorabo die et nocte, ending that sequence of Vespers music for the Feast of the Rosary, as it might have been celebrated in northern Italy, perhaps even in Venice, 400 years ago. It began with Viadanus, Deus in Adjutorium, and Psalm 109, Dixit Dominus. Next came Bassano's divisions on Introduxit me Rex by Palestrina, played by cornetist Gawain Glenton, sackbut player Emily White, and organist Catherine Pierron. Then two more of Viadana's 1612 psalm settings, Laetatus Sum and Lauda Jerusalem, and between them his delectable morsel, O Dulcissima Maria, sung by Claire Wilkinson with organist David Roblo and lutenist Linda Sace. They were performed by I Fagiolini, the English Cornet and Sackbut Ensemble, and the City Music in varied permutations, directed by Robert Hollingworth. And indeed, the varied permutations are now taking a few moments to move around the stage and get themselves set up for the next piece. Now, Robert Hollingworth, at the beginning of the concert, mentioned the detective work necessary. I'm delighted to say that sitting beside me in the presenter's box here is the sleuth himself, former Radio 3 producer Hugh Keat. Hugh, welcome. It's very good to see you. It comes full circle. You were the producer of Early Music Forum, sort of the grandparent of the Early Music Show of today.
Indeed, it's, yes, carries the flag forward.
Now, tell me, a big question. Modern practice with the restoration of historic buildings is to leave things untouched. Do you want us, with this next piece we're going to hear, the Magnificat of Gabrieli, do you want us to hear the joins?
Well, modern practice, that's what William Morris and his Society for the Protection of Ancient Buildings was in favour of. Leave things so that you can see what had gone wrong. The other alternative, which a lot of people do, is to try to restore something as near as possible to what it originally was. And my predilection is always to try and get as close to the original as possible, especially when it's a masterwork like this Magnificat.
It's an unusual Magnificat textually because it has this repeated, rather sort of triumphalist line, consequit locutus est, as he promised to our forefathers. Now, does that hark back to something they were celebrating?
I'm convinced, one can't prove this because the whole thing is a bit of a mystery. I'm convinced that Gabrieli wrote the piece for some kind of celebration of a military victory in Venice. And the most likely, by far the most likely, is the annual celebrations, one of the annual celebrations of the great victory of the Holy League at Lepanto, or Lepanto, which one is supposed to say.
Back in 1571.
In 1571, indeed. And then I think somebody, possibly one of his pupils, Giovanni Priuli or Giovanni Valentini, who became maestro or maestri at the Archducal Court of Graz in Austria, I think one of those two probably arranged it for seven choirs because that court loved things on a huge scale. So granted that it's for a military victory, what this repeated thing is, it's actually the last verse of the psalm, as he promised to our forefathers, Abraham and his seed forever. It's actually God making the Holy League and especially Venice victorious. God promised to Abraham that his seed would be like the fishes in the sea, the birds in the sky, and a chosen people, and that then became the Christians and the Venetians.
And I think we can look forward to some militaristic special effects. Gabrieli's Magnificat in a reconstruction by Hugh Keat.
Thank you.
Well, what a wonderful response to having this music performed in the Royal Albert Hall, where everything can be seen and the dome rises high. A really triumphal Magnificat, with the addition not only of some special effects of bells and cannon fire from outside, but also a trumpeter and two drummers standing up just behind the bust of old timber, Henry Wood himself, who I think may be smiling. That was Gabrieli's Magnificat con il sicut locutus, reconstructed by Hughey, performed by E. Fagiolini, directed by Robert Hollingworth. And I have to report that most of the players and singers on stage, almost everybody except the lute players, are standing to perform, and while we were listening to that, so was the musicologist who reconstructed that piece, Hugh Keat. Hugh, you obviously felt that it wasn't sitting down music.
I was just so excited, Kate, that I couldn't sit down.
That was really quite a reconstruction. I have to say, I didn't hear the join.
Thank you. 15 years worth, that was.
But no reconstruction is like any other, and we're moving on for the last piece in tonight's programme. First, we're going to hear a gem by Monteverdi, but let us talk about Gabrieli's In Ecclesiis. This is a piece that I thought I knew. I think I thought I'd sung it when I was at the Guildhall School, but this is different. What have you done?
What I've done is to restore it as Gabrieli wrote it. Whether I've got it exactly right, I don't know, but it's much, much closer than what survives in the posthumous 1615 Sinfonia Sacrae, published, edited by a colleague, a trombonist composer colleague, at St Mark's. Paul McCreesh was the first person to realise that some of the motets in that 1615 volume must be almost skeletons of what Gabrieli wrote. And what seems to have happened is that when the St Mark's choir and players were hired out to perform in parish churches, they simply cut all the parts that were not essential. They actually removed the parts, and then when they came to edit it, they got lost. I've restored them as far as I can.
Well, that's very, very good to hear. Well, tonight's prom ends with a Baroque world premiere, Hugh Keat's reconstruction of Gabrieli's late masterpiece, published posthumously 3 years after he died in 1615, In Ecclesiis, Bless the Lord in His Temples, Alleluia. And before that, we'll hear Monteverdi's simple, heartfelt antiphon to the Virgin Queen of Heaven, Salve Regina.
Salve, 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 salve.
God is our helper forever, alleluia. The final words of Giovanni Gabrieli's In Ecclesiis ringing out in the Royal Albert Hall to end tonight's concert of Italian sacred music. That piece was reconstructed by Hugh Keaton. My thanks very much to you for joining me in the presenter's box. He says that his work on this piece, and indeed the Magnificat we heard before, has been a labour of love, underpinned by a rigorous analysis of what survives. And in the case of In Ecclesiis, it's a brutally cut-down version that Gabrieli never heard himself. Hugh is very nicely placed in the box to take a round of applause for his efforts in a moment. I'm sure Robert will be getting him up. Tonight's performers of Vespers music for the annual feast of Our Lady of the Most Holy Rosary, all directed by Robert Hollingworth, were the singers of I Fagiolini, expanded in number to 33 for the occasion, with I Fagiolini's string players, organists, the orbists, and unusually percussionists, perhaps marking the feast's origins in a famous sea battle. And two Proms debut ensembles, the English Cornet and Sackbut Ensemble and the City Music. With such a large cast of Baroque virtuosi, it's impossible to give you all the names, but the full programme is available to enjoy online at the Radio 3 website, and a very good read it is too. I'll just quickly read the names of tonight's featured singers. Soprano Julia Doyle, mezzo-soprano Claire Wilkinson, countertenor William Purefoy, tenors Nicholas Herndl, Smith, Matthew Long and Nicholas Mulroy, baritones Eamon Dugan and Greg Skidmore, basses Christopher Adams and Charles Gibbs. I Fagiolini have already made several Proms appearances at Cadogan Hall, but tonight was their first outing to the Royal Albert Hall, and I think it's fairly safe to say, probably not their last. For now, though, with applause continuing, it's a very good night for me, Catherine Bott, as I hand you back to James Jolly in Broadcasting House.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to Broadcasting House. And we return to the Royal Albert Hall for our next Prom tomorrow evening at 7:30, when Vasily Petrenko conducts the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra in music by Delius and Shostakovich. And there's the first London performance of Peter Maxwell Davis's latest symphony, No. 9. That's all from 7:30 tomorrow evening here on BBC Radio 3.
On Radio 3, Glyndebourne comes to the BBC Proms. Almost 80 years since The Marriage of Figaro was first performed at Glyndebourne, Robin Ticciardi conducts a semi-staging of Glyndebourne's new production at the Royal Albert Hall. Vito Priante takes the title role in Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. Join me, Susie Klein, at the BBC Proms here on Radio 3 this Tuesday evening at 6:30.
Now, today's the 150th birthday of Claude Debussy. So here to take us to Lake Junction, which starts at 12:45, is Debussy's Violin Sonata from 1915, written just a few years before his death. It's played by Jennifer Pike and Martin Roscoe.
Thank you.
The Violin Sonata by Claude Debussy, 150th birthday of whom today. It was played by Jennifer Pike and Martin Roscoe. Now, we've a couple of minutes before Late Junction, so to get us in the mood, music from Ariana Saval, a traditional Catalan folk song in her own arrangement, Josep y Maria. Josep y Maria, arranged and sung by Ariana Saval and Petter Ulland Johansson with friends. This is BBC Radio 3. This week, Late Junction is broadcasting live from the International Edinburgh Festival. And this evening, we join Verity Sharp and guests from the BBC's Edinburgh studios at the Tun for the latest from the Edinburgh Fringe.
Yes, it's true. We've had to forego those twinkling fairy lights of that wonderful blue tent at the BBC Fringe venue tonight. And we've hunkered down in rather a small studio here in Edinburgh for this shorter edition of Late Junction. Shorter, but in no way any the less rich. King Creosote is here waiting to play for you in a moment. And so too are two demigods of the guitar world, two men who've been working hard to bring the strictly classical together with its more liberal jazz cousin. And in so doing, they've created something even greater than the sum of its parts. They are John Williams and John Etheridge. Thank you. Isn't it wonderful how transporting music is? I don't know if anybody listening can would have nailed where that music came from. I can tell you because I know, because I was told. That was a traditional piece from Cape Verde. It's a piece called Toy, arranged by Rufino Almeida. It's such a joy to watch you two, not because, obviously, you're masters of your own instruments, but you obviously just enjoy playing together. It was a great concert this morning at the Queen's Hall, wasn't it? And you obviously so enjoyed it.
Yeah, we did, in spite of it being in the morning.
11 o'clock in the morning.
It's a terrible time. I have played earlier once at 10 o'clock in the morning, but that's it's okay.
Yeah, that is the earliest I've ever played a public performance, I think. Yeah.
There's a kind of synergy. Is that almost a too strong a word between the two of you now? Because you've been playing together like this for, 6 years? I mean,
and before that, in a group. Yeah.
Yeah, before that, we were doing a lot of African music in a group which we call the Magic Box. There were five of us in that, but after that, the guitars mix so well together. You know, John's the acoustic steel string and the electric and the so-called Spanish or classical guitar, but the sounds blend in lots of different ways. So musically, there's a terrific variety, you know.
Yes, yes, exactly. We're going to hear, because, you met in the sort of the music, with your equal, I suppose, love of the music of West Africa and Africa in general. Yep. So we're going to hear more of that a little bit later on. But I am going to turn to our other guests who we have here in the studio tonight to describe Kenny Anderson, who's probably best known to us all as King Creosote. As prolific is probably something of an understatement. Something like 40 albums you've produced, Kenny, over the last 14 or 15 years or so. Diamond Mine was the one that came to the world's attention probably last year because it was nominated for the Mercury Prize. But of course, he hasn't stopped there. He's brought to the studio with him tonight a singer called Amy McDougall, and they're first going to sing us a song. It's called It'll all end in tears, all mine. It'll end in tears, all mine.
Yeah, I get it wrong as well. I was almost going to join in with your G and D there.
Quite daunting for you, I would imagine, being in this studio with these two.
Well, this first lyric can pretty much say it all.
That's a genetic disease. There's no help for me. Is that all right then? Is that all right then? You made me pushing me too far this time. It's going to end in tears, oh, all mine. It's going to end in tears. Just being told that I am the worst one here. You think that makes me the worst of the three? My bad temper, well, that's a genetic disease. There's no help for me. It's going to end in tears.
Beautiful stuff. It'll end in tears, all mine. King Creosote and Amy McDougall singing for you live here in the studio in Edinburgh as part of the Edinburgh Festival. I was talking to our producer, Georgia, just before he came on air, and we reckon, Kenny, that you've got the voice of Scotland. You've got this Scottish melancholia.
Oh, wow.
What do you think?
Drink gaddled.
But it's true, though, isn't there? There's a real sadness. There's a lot of sadness in the songs that you write.
I think it's when... Well, people ask why they're all sad. It's kind of, I think when you're down and sad, that's when you write songs. If you're happy, you're outside laughing with everybody else.
So that's where the creative spirit really kicks in.
Yeah, I think so. That's, I don't know. Well, I write songs to kind of deal with things. And if you're... that's just the way I handle all the good stuff. Mm.
You live in... Well, I think you still live in East Newark.
I'm still in Crail, in the village of Crail.
The little village
it's
of Crail.
Apparently the most painted harbour in Scotland. I don't mean that they've been out and painted the rocks. I mean oil paints.
And is that, Amy, are you there? Are you from that area too?
No, I'm from Edinburgh, born and bred. So
how did you two first meet?
Actually, I was nanny on tour for another band that Kenny used to sing with and was just really jealous and wanted to be on stage.
Are you part of the Fence Collective?
Working with Kenny's big band, yeah. That's really good fun.
Yeah. But East Newark and the landscape around there is obviously a huge inspiration to you. Would you ever sort of consider moving to the heady lights of Edinburgh or even Glasgow?
No, I never really settled in the city, really. The thing about, East Newark, obviously the sea's there, that's a massive influence on, but I think it's more the sort of type of people that are in the East Newark. There's a real sort of humble kind of... East Newquers. There's no rush, basically, to do anything. So,
and that's what you need.
They still have the back in 10 minutes signs on the shops and half day Wednesday. There's a really kind of droll character goes around the East Newquay. Just very unassuming. Every day you hear something that you could poach for a song.
And Fife in general has been such an inspiration to all sorts of people, hasn't it? Ian Anderson, Jethro Tull, Barbara Dixon came from Fife.
Dunfermline, was he here?
James Yorkston, of course, who's one of your Fence Collective.
Yeah, he's King's
Fence
Bands.
Collective being a sort of, the bigger musical family that you've created up there, I suppose, for your Fence.
We need to get Barbara Dixon in the Fence Collective.
That would be good.
Yeah,
that would
be, really
be great. And then, of course, you're here at the Edinburgh Festival. I know you love a festival. Hopefully Edinburgh's up there on your kind of wish list, and you're going to be at the Queen's Hall... Tomorrow night,
yeah. I've got an 8-piece or 10-piece band tomorrow night.
Nice one.
Strings and things.
Okay, what are you going to sing for us next?
This is a song from the Diamond Mine record called Bubble.
I won't let you fall lows I've been. I promise to crawl until I'm back on my feet. If something were wrong, do you think something were wrong? Don't you know that I'd be here? So who's been unfair? Who causes you sorrow? And who's been unkind? Now I rain, squall, and all weather. You're a Eurygrass that rub out the present. I'll abuse at the scorn upon treasure. I won't let you fall as low as I've been. I promise to crawl until I'm back on my.
That's Bubble, as sung by King Creosote and Amy McDoodle, live in the studio. More from them a little bit later on. You're listening to Late Junction with me, Verity Sharp, live from the Edinburgh Festival. Great photos from last night's concert can be found on the Late Junction page of the Radio 3 website. You can also find us on Twitter at BBC Radio 3. And of course, the programmes will be available on the iPlayer for you to listen to for the next 7 days if you happen to miss anything or want to hear it all over again. Anybody who's spent any time at this festival knows just what an indulgence, if not an overindulgence, it is for the senses. And this morning, even before I'd reached the Queen's Hall to hear John Williams and John Etheridge give their concert at coffee time, I'd found myself in a room listening to what has to be some of the world's oldest music, revered courtly music from Japan, which has been preserved and protected by musicians for over 1,000 years. It's called Gagaku, which literally means elegant music. What an incredibly rich and powerful sound that is. The ancient music from Japan called Gagaku, played there by just three, can you believe it, of the musicians of the Imperial Household Agency in Tokyo, who've come to perform at the Edinburgh Festival for the very first time. And this is, in fact, one of the very rare occasions that the music is ever performed in public. Ordinarily, this is music for private ceremony. Shogo Anzai is the chief musician for the Imperial Household Agency. And Mr. Anzai, I think the first thing that strikes me is the sheer volume of this music. It makes me wonder if this is music to be played outside or in huge palatial spaces.
Yes, it is the case that it was often performed outside, mostly with the principal reason being that it was an accompaniment to dance, and the dance was performed outside, so the noise had to be loud.
Jiro Okuyama is the Master of Ceremonies for the Imperial Household Agency. Mr. Okuyama, because this is very, very
old music, isn't it? I mean, do we know actually how old it is?
I think the oldest starting point was around the 5th century AD, and Japan imported music from the Chinese continent. These imports were mixed with what had been there traditionally in Japan, and then they grew up and gradually Japanized. Musical instruments were sorted out to cater to the needs of the Japanese ears. So over the course of 5 centuries, up until the 10th century AD, it gradually formed itself into what it is now, the current gagaku.
Literally the same music from the 10th AD to now. How has it managed to be preserved so perfectly?
There were hereditary musicians' families which were called gakke, and they are still called gakke. So music families. And basically the male line of that hereditary, century-old hereditary families actually carried this tradition down all the generations.
Mr. Anza, we're hearing 3 instruments here. Can you just describe each one?
The shō, which is sometimes called the, translated as a mouth organ, is a very special instrument. It creates chords, but they're different from the chords that you might hear in Western music. And what's particularly interesting is that the chords support the melody from above. It's like a harmony from above the melody rather than below, which is what you get in Western music. The second instrument, the hichiriki, which is sometimes translated as an oboe, is the instrument that plays the melody, the main melody of the music. And then the final instrument is ryuteki, which is a kind of flute, and that plays music in between the melody of the hichiriki and the chords of the mouth organ, the shō.
And Mr. Okuyama, how unusual is it for this music to be performed somewhere like the Edinburgh International Festival for a public audience?
The music department of the Imperial Household actually played performances overseas, and they made overseas performances 7 times after the World War II. And last time in the UK, it was 1970 and 1976 at the Royal Albert Hall. So as far as the UK is concerned, it's after an interval of 36 years.
So, Mr. Anzai, how did you come to learn and play this music? Were you born into a hereditary family?
I'm not actually a member of one of those traditional musical families. I just, from an ordinary household, but when I was young, I had the opportunity to join.
It must take years of training.
I joined when I was 12, and I'm now 64, so that's 52 years of long, hard practice.
The musicians of the Imperial Household Agency in Tokyo bringing the arresting music and dance of the Japanese gagaku to the Edinburgh Festival for the first time ever. I was talking to the chief musician Shogo Anzai and the master of ceremonies Jiro Okuyama, and my thanks to Mary Morton for translating. You're listening to Late Junction on BBC Radio 3, and by way of contrast, which of course is what we like on this programme, here is John Etheridge to play God Bless the Child by Billie Holiday. Thank you.
Lovely stuff. God Bless the Child by Billie Holiday, as played by John Etheridge. And he's here with John Williams. We've been listening to them as a duo at the Edinburgh Festival. And, of course, they're here in the studio. And I think you're going to play a couple of pieces next inspired by African music. And as we were saying, that's the kind of common ground on which the two of you met. But, I mean, John Williams, I mean, you forged, obviously, such an amazing career for yourself as a classical musician. What was it that really made you want to go out and explore music of other cultures and look elsewhere?
I don't know. It just happens. I think, you know, in London, you come across so many things. You hear so much music. I've always loved African music anyway, generally. So,
did you want to kind of challenge yourself technically as well at all?
Not really. What's interesting is that the feel, well, we say African music, but I mean, it's so much, it's different depending on whereabouts in Africa you are. I mean, totally different, you know, the influences. But the general feel is different. You know, there's of course, you have a lot of drumming and a lot of very rhythmical music, but there's also a kind of rhythmical feel in their music, which is very loose. You know, our European music is quite square, really, if you think about it. Even the popular music is all quite downbeaty. And so I've always loved that aspect. And it, with Latin American music or South American music or Caribbean music, the African influence is so strong that I think some of the great life in that comes, you know, from Africa. And, of course, it's the mixture then. So just, you know, through the guitar's natural... what's the word? Natural...